This is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 18, and we have a special SPEP edition of the podcast in which I'm joined here in Arlington, Virginia, by Noelle McAfee, who is research professor at the Institute for Social and for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. She has numerous publications in the era of democratic political theory, social political philosophy, feminist theory, and American pragmatism, including three books, Habermas, Kristeva, and Citizenship by Cornell University Press in 2000, Julia Kristeva, published by Routledge in 2003, and a text that Shannon Sullivan and I discussed on episode 8 of The Digital Dialogue entitled Democracy and the Political Unconscious, which was just published in 2008. Today, she is here to talk further about her book and to explore the transformative possibilities digital media opens for politics. Yesterday, SPEP held an excellent book panel on Noelle's book in which Shannon Sullivan of Penn State University and Robin Marasco of Hunter College commented and Noelle responded. So a number of issues that grow out of that panel discussion may be discussed this afternoon. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Noelle McAfee to the Digital Dialogue.
Chris, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, I'd love to start by talking a little bit about, maybe we should do a little bit about the basic structure of the book to give people a sense of people who didn't, by the way, listen to episode 8 of the Digital Dialogue, about your book. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of structure of it?
Yes, this was a book that began really in March 2004 on the day of the Madrid bombings. Mm-hmm. I was in my living room listening to the rhetoric coming from the Spanish Minister of Culture or something saying, we are going to hunt them down, they were going to kill them. Right. They were, I think, sure it was ETA at that point.
Right.
We're going to hunt them down and kill them. I can't remember exactly who it was responsible, but it wasn't that party. And the whole idea that they would hunt them down and kill them,
right,
rather than try to find a way to solve this problem, to talk to them, just struck me as just more insanity. Just the
right.
same thing that we saw after our own 9/11.
Right.
It was this, we're going to hunt them down to kill them. Whenever, and then before, remember as a kid
right.
in the 70s, the mantra, which has some sense,
yeah,
but the mantra that we do not negotiate with terrorists.
Right.
Basically, if you are a terrorist, if you are beyond the pale, we will not talk with you.
Right.
It's really interesting, by the way, that in this last presidential election, this very thing became an issue.
Right.
Rather,
exactly.
we talk with the enemy.
Exactly.
Now, it seems to me that if you don't talk with the enemy, well, I guess one hope is somehow us not talking with you is going to
teach
bully
you, a lesson.
It's going to teach you a lesson, or it's going to bully you into changing your way so you will talk to us.
Right.
Rather than seeing talking as transformative.
Exactly.
And engaging, not
exactly.
just talking, but actually being with, talking, trying to do something. And I don't mean just reasoning, but actually
sure.
trying to engage.
Exactly.
And change a relationship.
Right.
Anyway, this is all kind of the prologue to the structure of the book.
Yeah.
But the structure of the book really is trying to understand, in using the language of psychoanalysis,
mm-hmm.
the language of it,
right.
not so much literally,
right.
using the language of psychoanalysis to try to understand this repetition compulsion that we're in. That in a way you could say that 9/11 was a trauma, then the Madrid bombings were a repetition
right.
of that, and the reaction to both was a repetition, and then we'll go in and we'll have a war on terror,
mm-hmm.
that in one chapter I call it the repetition compulsion or the endless war on terror.
Exactly.
It's the same thing,
exactly.
right?
Yeah.
So the idea here is, they're true traumas. This
right.
isn't to take away from
right.
the grievousness of what happens. But those traumas are both born from a previous trauma
mm-hmm.
and give rise to other traumas, reenactments, unless we find some way to
yeah.
break out of this.
What's really remarkable is that one of the things that I taught last spring was this course on force and power and reading some of the Greek tragedies where this cycle of violence is perpetrated over the course of generations, and until some move is made that transforms it out of a violent force vocabulary, so to speak, if you can speak of force as a kind of vocabulary, it will just be repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It'll be repeated over and over. So Clytemnestra, has to kill Agamemnon for the death of Iphigenia, and then of course Orestes has to kill Clytemnestra, and it's only until Athena begins to establish a court where talking becomes critical. So that's one of the things that I think is really important. Where, how does that transformation happen from a politics of violence to one where I don't want to say rationality, but talking and deliberation and dialogue can break that cycle.
Yeah. It's things that people, my children, right? They'll get into these repetition compulsions. Well, he did it. He did it. She did it. This will never end unless we kind of start over here. And my colleague at the Kettering Foundation, Hal Saunders, says that really politics is about changing relationships.
Right.
And he's worked for decades, you know, going back to helping negotiate the Arab-Israeli peace agreement under Carter and changing relationships.
Right.
And until that happens, you will have this going on.
Right.
So you can use that language as well. So psychoanalysis, in a way, is a way of changing our relationship to this previous trauma.
Exactly.
And instead of a vengeance or repetition. So there, and also this book draws a lot on Freud, especially this little book that most of us read in college, Civilization and Its Discontents.
Right.
Now, read it in an afternoon. It's terrific.
Yeah.
So there you have this notion that that beings are born with energy and drive, and something has to happen with that, right? We are just like seething, teeming and seething with energy and drive. And it's not just Freud's sexual stuff. It's just all kinds of drive when you look at an infant who's trying to get his or her way in the world. So something has to happen with that. And in our kind of civilized world, we can't just act on all of our drives.
Right.
We're told you got to behave yourself. Put your clothes on, right?
Right.
So we have to find ways to somehow turn that energy into something, to let it out in some way.
Right.
And it can be let out through maybe fantasy or going to a museum and enjoying, or you could just try to quash it by getting drunk and all that. Or another way is to turn it, that affect, into some kind of a work that circulates in a world with others.
Right.
So part of the idea here is that what it seems to be phenomenologically that people want is to participate in a world with others.
Right.
And one way that happens is by taking some kind of affect or drive and turning it into a novel or a garden or a building.
Right.
When I was an undergrad and read that book, I just had this image of all of these edifices of civilization where people's affects turned into drive.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Right.
All of these.
Yeah, and it's this creative capacity of that. So on Freud's vocabulary, that's a vocabulary of sublimation. Is that right?
Okay.
So that certainly is a powerful, offers a powerful possibility for creating and changing relationships.
Yeah.
And of course, ruining relationships.
Right. Or if we have a broken relationship,
what
often we want to hurt the other and get them where they live.
Right.
So part of this theory is that where people live is they want to live in this public world with others. So to get them where they live is to cut them off from access to that.
Right.
Part of the argument too is that brutal regimes target people's membership in the public sphere.
Right.
But
they
say, you do not belong here. You are not worth listening to, and you should be afraid, and we're not going to listen to you. We're going to treat you as not fully human.
Right.
So anyway, all these things were part of what lead to trauma, people being left cut out from the public sphere, or trauma happens instead of dealing with it, working through it in some way, just repeating it, either through repetition or negation or repression.
Right.
So it's taking the language of psychoanalysis and metaphorically, but not just that, it's also seeing that what happens to us individually, whether we are allowed opportunity to sublimate and participate in this public world, does affect what the public world is.
Mm-hmm.
So in the United States, through most of its history, there were people who were just not included there.
Right.
You know, blacks, people of color, women. Mm-hmm. So the public sphere looked like a white man's world.
Right.
And it was a white man's world.
Right.
But what was empty, what was not present there, we could call the kind of political unconscious of the country.
Okay.
That it was repressed or cut out and not allowed to take shape there. So women, blacks, other people of color didn't see themselves.
Now, is the unconscious for you something that is the result of the process of repression and suppression, or is it just a natural part? I mean, not natural, but it is just a part. Well, maybe I do want to say natural, but of political body politic in a certain way. Maybe this gets to a distinction between politics and so the political and the social. But what I guess I'm wondering about is there a kind of an ideal operating that we could get rid of the unconscious? And let's say if we allowed people to sublimate in healthy ways all of their drives and allowed them to participate, is that a kind of ideal, or is there something else going on with the unconscious?
I don't know if we'd have anything we could recognize ourselves as human, or recognize a culture as a civilization in many ways we like.
Right.
If we didn't have an unconscious.
Right.
If people weren't finding other avenues to express their and sublimate their,
right.
We would not have buildings and libraries.
Right.
And works of art,
right.
And the things we like.
So the question then is to have it shape things that are politically healthy for all of
us. Yeah, well-functioning.
Well-functioning, exactly.
Let's say well-functioning.
Bring the pragmatism.
well-functioning with an ideal of full, my democratic ideal is that all who are affected by matters of common concern have an opportunity to shape matters of common concern.
Right.
So given that we have this kind of these limits. On the one hand, we can't just act on everything.
Right, right.
Imagine here the mythical kind of space in which everybody could act on their desires. The kind of
the
tropical island
right.
where everybody's running around naked and
right.
having sex whenever they want to and eating whenever they want to. And it's just idyllic. But do they have any books or no?
This is what Odysseus turned down on the island of Calypso. With Calypso, right? I mean, in some ways, he turns back and says, and I think this is an embrace of his finitude in some way. And I guess that's part of the question that I was having is, isn't the unconscious just endemic to finitude, to human finitude?
Yeah. And I think it's also what we recognize as human. And I think my idea here is kind of old-fashioned, but the idea is that sublimation turns us from being our animal, kind of in the animal sense, to human.
Right.
That we see ourselves as civilized people who obey certain kinds of norms and treat each other in a certain way, or part of a common...
Right.
Civilization, a culture with others, is part of our humanity.
Right.
And now instances of desublimation would include the death camps, Holocaust, where people literally, and Terence Dupré talks about this, the desublimation of the death camps. People were stripped of, they had to give up their regular clothing, their jewelry, all of their belongings, and were just basically rendered animal and not human. That was truly, I mean, that's not an accident that happens to make you animal again.
Yeah.
I was off on that. On the one hand, we might have that where you could act on all of your desires, this kind of mythical island.
Right.
And on the other hand, we have that we don't want to be so constrained that we are everything is repressed.
Right.
So that was part of Freud's concern too.
Right.
That,
right.
Civilization makes us guilty.
Right, right.
We were just walking around just with feeling of guilt that we didn't do this, didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we have that and be happy and have the best of it?
Well, I have a question then, maybe a more technical question about sublimation and desublimation on Freud's terms then, because on the one hand, is it the case that that sublimation is good? It produces things that are part of a functioning world? And that's positive, whereas desublimation is, let's say, terrorist bombings, an attempt to articulate oneself or get involved in the process when one feels alienated from it, when one feels excluded from it.
I was using desublimation very specifically to mean the effect of being deprived of opportunities to sublimate.
Okay, got it.
So that what that does is it doesn't just hurt that individual, it says to that it hurts the political public sphere.
Right.
It says the political public sphere is going to look like this and not like that. It's going to just look like we white folks or we Aryan Nation or we, and not these others.
Right.
By those people being cut out from participating in a public sphere, it changes. But what happens is that whoever is cut out, whether it's the people we like or dislike or whatever our ideological views are, those who don't have that opportunity to participate and help shape their future don't have any other avenues and are left, and kind of there we have the seething discontent of the political unconscious.
One of the things that is really, I think, powerful about the way you frame the book is this movement from speechlessness to participation, trying to replace the image of dependence to independence. And so I wonder if you could talk maybe a little bit about a kind of critique of autonomy that you, I think that's a strand in this text. Would you embrace that as an idea?
I'd say I have a critique of ideal of independence.
Independence, okay.
Which good. I distinguish independence from autonomy.
Okay.
Yeah. So the traditional story that's just the common sense story we're growing up is that babies are born dependent, and human babies really need to be taken care of for a long time, but eventually the ideal is to get to them where they can take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we're graded through school and how well we can do our work individually, independently, and that's the ideal. Well, there's something to that.
Right.
But really, I think a better account of our condition is that we are born speechless, or mm-hmm. infants, you know, the Latin's for speechless, to mm-hmm. beings who can participate in a world with others.
Right.
So the distinction is between an ideal that human kind of flourishing is about participation in a world with others versus independence.
Right.
The old story that's not very helpful and doesn't really describe things very well is that our real nature is to be individual.
Right.
And often the term autonomy gets connected with
that. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I did a podcast with John Chrisman, who's a colleague of mine at Penn State, and he's just written a book called The Politics of Persons, and we talked about this book. And in that book, he tries to defend a conception of autonomy that takes seriously the situated individual and takes seriously the image of the individual as bound up with history and contextualized in all kinds of robust and interesting, important mm-hmm. ways. So I'm glad to hear that you're making this distinction between sort of a kind of atomistic, individualistic story about the independent one versus a conception of autonomy that might be much more robust.
Well, we can even look in Kant and find this other.
Yeah.
Can say the act so as you make yourself by your action, I forget the exact words,
right.
a member of a kingdom of ends,
right.
of humanity,
right.
to
right.
act as if you're a member of humanity.
Right.
And that's a better way of thinking about it than just act according to some cold calculation.
Right. Right. Can you talk a little bit about the, one of the themes that I've been thinking about, and we've been coming up in these different episodes, is the question of the erotic, the nature of the erotic in the Freudian Platonic sense, and what pulls us toward participation, what pulls us toward one another. And I don't mean it in a sexual way, but I mean that in a political sense and in a social sense. And I see, I hear something about what you're saying as a movement from speechlessness to participation as driven in a certain way by a way of participating in the erotic movement of human finitude in a certain way, that we as young people are just naturally drawn to each other. Well, first of all, we need to be together because we have to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that comes this this political, social, political necessity. But more than that, I mean that we are who we are by virtue of this participation.
Yeah, and well, Freud uses the term in that same book of social eros.
Right.
So if we can't be fully erotic the way
right.
our drives, our libidinal drives
right.
would have us, then we kind of have this kind of second best is that we're drawn to, there's a kind of eros of wanting to be a part of this social world.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
I love too, and there's a lot of commonality between Nietzsche and Freud. You can read some of their texts together.
Right.
We're really kind of born with just power and energy in the Nietzschean sense.
Yeah.
And in this, it's just life. It's
right.
just this life
right.
force.
Right.
And it needs to kind of go somewhere.
Yeah.
And narcissism, in Freud's term, is a kind of where it doesn't go anywhere. It just kind of get totally self-involved.
Right.
And we don't connect and join a world with others.
Mm-hmm.
So better to send this energy out and
right.
be part of a world
right.
with other people. So it's very, I think,
yeah.
libidinal and full of energy and,
right.
and desire.
Yeah.
yeah.
So then one of the things that I would be interested in having to talk with, I read this last chapter of your book, which focuses on digital media and the possibilities that offers for sublimation, and if we can use that vocabulary, in this positive way. Participation and I think you may use the vocabulary of making the public audible, which
mm-hmm.
doing a podcast is good to hear
yeah.
that it is. But it's also, I mean, I take you to mean audible, not just in terms of sound, but also in terms of written articulation, video, all this sort of thing that the digital, the diverse aspects of digital media give us.
Yeah.
Us.
So the where the first half of the book I talk about the horror of, you know, trauma and repetition and the endless war on terror, in the last part is thinking about a kind of, in quotation marks, talking cure.
Right.
Where we look at the power of deliberative public forums or truth and reconciliation commissions and different kinds of democratic institutions through which we can become involved. And the last chapter is on media, new kinds of media.
Right.
So there's a couple things coming together there.
Yeah.
One is drawing on the Habermasian and Deweyan conceptions of the public.
Right.
Now, both separately, of course, Dewey because Habermas wasn't alive yet, and then Habermas later, independently of reading Dewey, could develop a conception of the public sphere or the public that forms communicatively.
Uh-huh.
For Habermas, maybe in the coffee shops of 18th century Europe, and Dewey maybe through radio, that... Here we are, individuals kind of disconnected or whatever, doing things, and we become a public. A public comes into being around sets of problems.
Mm-hmm.
But in our busy, complex world, even in Dewey's day, and problems seem so complicated, and we're disconnected from each other. We need means of communication to connect with each other, to understand our problems, see, see what's causing them. Oh, it's that, you know, factory down the road that's polluting the river, and then say, oh, and it's hurting you in this way, and you in this way, and oh, me too. And so we see ourselves, as we see find ourselves jointly affected by this problem and identifying what the problem is, and then together we could develop some idea about what to do about the problem.
Right.
So that's what how publics are not things or groups. That's a kind of phenomena that comes together when people communicatively identify and decide what to do about problems.
Does that get to a distinction between the social and the political, or how?
I think so. This, you know, this is a public is generally involved in we'd say in political things, matters of common concern.
I think I might be worried about that because of Socrates, and maybe we can get back to that because I think Socrates is intentionally trying to turn individuals to larger questions that might be of common concern, and I think that might be what he's up to in terms of what Socratic politics might mean. So I'll leave that go, but I'd rather get back to, to the Habermas.
All right, so Habermas makes a similar move, of course, in his discourse ethics. So we have a communicatively created public sphere, or public. And Dewey said that, but you know, to have this, we need ways for those winged words of conversation to come together.
Right.
And I think in his day he was thinking of the radio.
Yeah.
Maybe telephone, but telephones are individual. Now, as Horkheimer and Adorno talked about, we had developed the culture industry, and we did have means of communication, but they were one way.
Right.
Right? They were kind of from a few to the many.
Yeah.
There's no way to talk back to that. Right. So from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and for a long time, the left was very critical, rightly so, of the media.
Right.
Because it was like that.
Right.
And the computers seemed to create a shift.
Yeah.
Frederick Jameson said, you know, maybe the postmodern era began with the computer chip or the television.
Somewhere
there was a shift here with the computer creating something different. But
anyway,
I've gotten involved in a lot of new media work with public media organizations and all of research for some other projects and learned a whole lot about this new world. So we could say that the web, the creation of the web with the first web browsers turned what had been kind of the black screen on your computer with a C prompt, and you have to enter in some obscure code to send a document from one place to the other, or go look at another document. And then with the first web browser, that changes things so we can actually see and see information back and forth much easier. It's just an easier way of doing the old thing. So there we have kind of, in a way, web 1.0.
1.0, right.
Well, and that really got going truly about 1995. By the beginning of the 21st century, we have social media.
Right.
Okay, it's the same kind of, basically, probably not the same code, but instead of just going and finding out what this one site has and getting the information, we now have spaces in which people can come together and kind of create common life and norms around whatever interests them.
Right.
So there is a way in which now you could say, using kind of the old language of politics of what the public wants, of, you know, well, what does the public want? Who's the public and what do they want?
Right.
Now we can actually kind of listen in.
Yeah.
You know, listen into the blogosphere and listen into different kind of social media sites and see what people are thinking and saying. You know.
Right, right. Right. Well, and I think, I mean, it's really helpful to hear that transition, because what I find so interesting is that my experience is, at this point, as somebody who's trying to leverage some of the social media to engage in public discourse, and even to perform certain kind of academic things that were sort of kept in an academic elite kind of place, and open them up in ways that I think might be really transformative, because I have no idea who might be listening to this or who isn't. And yeah. In fact, the idea is to just put it out there. It's important to me. And I always say about these podcasts, you know, the conversations that I have been having have just been great for me. I leave them exhilarated and transformed by them. So that's almost enough. But yeah. I do think this, when institutions like an educational institution are challenged, when the model is no longer the sage on the stage teacher delivering information to the students, as the old version of media used to be, turn the TV on and just be entertained. Mm-hmm. That's a shift that a lot of people are uncomfortable with. And yeah. It really means that we have to think a lot about, and this is part of the impetus behind the project, about what are the habits and the virtues that we need to cultivate with one another to respond in ways that are productive. And mm-hmm. it's not just about spouting off or you know, it may be about that too sometimes. That might be good, a good sublimation.
Yeah. And now, I was at a meeting last week with Dan Gilmore, who's a kind of leading thinker about new media and citizen journalism and all, and his phrase about this is that we used to have journalism that was a monologue, and right. now we have a conversation.
Right.
It's very unsettling for the people who used to be in the monologue
yeah.
business,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
But we have a conversation. And there's a whole, so much that goes on here. One is that we have that you and I are literally having a conversation right now.
Right.
And you'll put it on your on your
blog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And other
and
people
I'll go to iTunes you.
Other people will connect to that
right.
and maybe comment on it. Mm-hmm. They might comment on your web blog, mm-hmm. but they might link to it from their own web blog mm-hmm. and comment on it.
Or Facebook.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Or somebody might say, well, what a ridiculous book that is. And
right.
might, you know, say something else, and somebody might say, respond back and come. So it's not about the individual spouting off of the individual. You
right.
know, people criticize that, oh, the blogosphere is just a bunch of people with their trumpets sounding off. Who cares?
Right.
It's about a conversation,
mm-hmm.
not just between you and me right now, but between these other points all over the internet.
Right.
They go on online, and then conversations offline. Oh, did you know? You know what I listened
right.
to today? Let me tell you about what
right.
I heard. And it really is creating, in a way, a possibility
mm-hmm.
of creating a public conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say it's all to the good.
Right.
There can be destructive, terrible things that, and hurtful things
right.
that go on.
I mean, from my perspective, I think that's why it's a real responsibility for those of us committed to education to be in this media and to be practicing it and performing it in ways that might model kinds of conversations that are actually productive and helpful. And also recognizing when we don't do that. Like I was having this, we had a podcast recorded this morning with a panel of people from the Ancient Philosophy Society, and I was realizing that, you know, I need to learn about not jumping in too quickly. This was actually, it happened to be three women who were on the panel, and my tendency is to worry about silent moments. One of them pointed out afterwards that, you know, we could just edit the silent moments out if we have them. So that was actually good for me. But there's a way in which I'm learning too about how to conduct a dialogue
mm-hmm.
with another person and really listen and these other kinds of things that are hard to do.
Yeah. I was talking with some friends over lunch about different social media sites or so often people will join a community around some interest that they have, maybe
right.
running or weightlifting or any kind of thing that they're into. And often these sites will be places people come to talk about those things
right.
and share information. But people will also kind of develop an identity, even if they have just a handle, not their real name,
right.
an identity online.
Right.
And I asked, well, what about in the old days? It's not the old days, 10 years ago, when these were new, nascent sites. There'd be people who'd come on who'd be just really disruptive and mean.
Yeah.
You would call them
yeah.
flamers.
Right.
And
right,
they would
right.
just, they were so uncivil. And there was
mm-hmm.
worry that that there's this incivility that can go on when we're not having face-to-face conversation.
Right.
And we talked about how over time that seems to be handled better. It's like there's an intelligence that's created in these spaces about how to handle people who behave that way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in some ways it is because of the social dimension of Web 2.0, where what I'm more and more convinced of what we're really dealing with is the cultivation of communities. And so I'm really think that the Deweyan notion that learning happens in community is really the model that I have to be thinking about for the pedagogical practices that might inform some of these social media uses in education. So I've had some real success with having my students blogging, and they're writing much more than they ever would have written had I assigned 4 papers or whatever. But now I have some students from Boston College, because a colleague of mine, Marina McCoy, saw on Facebook that I was doing this, and she was teaching the Phaedrus too, and so she asked if her students could comment on our blog, and of course I said, yeah, it's open, you don't have to ask, jump in, this is part of the point, to blur those kinds of boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm more and more realizing it's really about community. And when you have a community and somebody behaves poorly, people in the community sort of come together to address that.
Yeah. So that is a lot of what goes on at the end of the book, is thinking about these other ways in which people can start to address, create community and address common matters. It's not real clear what's what. There's a woman, Rebecca McKinnon, who I've learned a lot from about the blogosphere. When I first really heard about it from her, she started this group called Global Voices Online with a colleague at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
Right.
So what they did was they have editors, kind of bloggers, who are in different points of the world, who will listen in on the blogosphere and their part of the world, and edit and provide a little links every morning to what people are talking about in India, or hear what people are talking about in Greece. And on this one website, you can click on the country and kind of hear what people are talking about that day.
Uh-huh.
Now, often those things are just social concerns or commentary about something or other, but sometimes a blog might be a mommy blog in India,
right,
where the different mommy bloggers are talking to each other about social, matters, and then something will come up that's a problem, like prenatal care, and their conversation will become political, really, about what do we do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a kind of it's a blur between social and political that happens online. And so these places that can be silent little or quiet little kind of corners of the big building that's the global civil society space can be just little small places people might kind of enter in, because here there's issues that are coming up, people are talking about it. It's very fluid and interesting.
Well, now I'm being haunted by the social political distinction, because I do think one of the radical dimensions of the way I understand Socratic politics, and the way I'm thinking about this, is how does the dramatic Socrates, who appears in the Platonic dialogues, perform politics? And part of my feeling is that he does it by entering into dialogue with individuals and getting them to think about the course of their lives and the question of how they're orienting their lives, and the question of the good and the just, and whether they are even considering that. And so I see him blurring this line between the individual and society, between the public and the private. And so he doesn't participate in politics in a, the way all these people want him to. It's like, go to the assembly and, argue. No, this is where I'm the one who practices the true politics, he says in the Gorgias, by making sure that my words are not oriented toward gratification, but toward the good. And so I wonder what happens in these moments, in these conversations, when something shifts and they recognize, these mommy bloggers in India recognize that they have a common concern and that they have a problem that they can focus on. Is that a continuation of this very personal relationship that they're having that just now is taking on another dimension? Or is this, do you want to make a strong distinction between the social and the political? I think I have social and political, public and private mixed up. I mean, in this
Well, I think it's helpful to be a process philosopher here, okay?
Let's
not think of these as things or places,
right.
But as phenomena,
right.
happenings. And Habermas said once in an interview, I believe, wherever two or more people come together to talk about matters of common concern, there's the public sphere.
Right.
So, you know, you and I can sit here in this hotel and talk about matters of public concern, and we're entering into a political discussion. This becomes a political, a political phenomena.
Right.
So the things, politics happens. Oh, Rebecca McKinnon also said that the blogosphere is not something, it's not citizen journalism. I've been in so many conversations with journalists who are at wit's end. They hate bloggers. They think that bloggers kill journalism. Because bloggers are trying to be journalists. They're getting press passes. They're going to, they hate them. And but Rebecca said, you know, occasionally there are random acts of journalism in the blogosphere. But really what you have is a conversation. It's a conversation that's going on. So that's those conversations sometimes will be about social matters, sometimes about private matters, and sometimes will be about political matters.
And I do think this related to the question of newspapers and what happens to newspapers. I mean, I think the sooner newspapers recognize this point we've been making about community, the better off they will be. Because what they have to recognize is they have cultivated over time a community around their paper. And if they allow that community to languish, and they think that the community revolves around them in a unidirectional way delivering the information to them, then they're going to die. But if they recognize that what they've really created is a community, and there's things that they talk about matter to people, and how do they continue to have that matter in a dynamic process way, then they're going to be in a much better position to survive and to thrive, I think, in this new social media landscape.
Yeah, and that is, that very topic is so important right now. I do a lot of work with the Kettering Foundation on media and democracy, and before that with American University and others. So the issue is that journalism used to be in the business, as you say, of just delivering the news,
right?
In the 1990s, a movement kind of came up that Jay Rosen helped get going, and the Knight Foundation and Kettering a little bit, what came to be called public journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And Jay Rosen, who's now big into blogging, Jay Rosen was involved in this, and he said, he would talk to reporters at newspapers and say, you know, the newspaper, if the community dies, there's no town newspaper.
Right.
So it really is part of the business of a newspaper to look after the welfare of the community, which, of course, runs right up against the old values of objectivity and disinterestedness.
Yeah.
So that was a big movement. It was a big, in a way, fight. The top-tier newspapers resisted this completely.
Right.
It was the middle-tier newspapers with smaller communities that said, they got that.
Right.
And this was before this was at the very beginning of the crisis of the newspaper industry.
Okay.
And there the crisis was that the two newspaper towns were becoming one newspaper town.
Right. Right, exactly.
Which is laughable now when there are towns without any newspaper.
Exactly.
But for the success, the self-interest of the newspapers, you better look after the community and have a relationship with them.
Right.
This was still, though, kind of still a one-way model. The internet just changed that.
Definitely.
Now the internet is becoming that kind of public square space that newspapers and TV and radio and others are just sort of things that are just exist only on the web we're creating to become a public square.
Right.
That's the future.
But I mean, what this exact issue is facing education right now. So what are we doing in our universities, in our colleges, where a lot of our faculty are really committed to it being Thursday and they're pulling out their lecture on X and they're going to deliver that lecture and the students are going to listen to that lecture and they're going to go off and do something. Do we have faculty are we cultivating faculty who can recognize that learning happens in community? It's about loosening some of the reins, giving the parameters, keeping, right? You're still teaching. You're still responsible for laying out the expectations and all of that. But that actually students are going to learn more effectively when they are able to write and participate and speak and using blogs or podcasts or whatever with one another and with the faculty member. And that's where learning is going to happen. And I think we in education have to recognize that this is happening, and it's really going to be transformative of education itself.
Yeah. So there's a couple things in what you're saying. One is to, for the scholar, professor, to think about his or her own work, not just as delivering information, but in what way is teaching kind of helping to constitute community and life,
right?
Private life, civic life,
right.
To think of it as an engagement.
Yeah.
And there is a whole movement now, really, of kind of engaged scholarship to think about it that way. And the other is to think about pedagogy itself and how do people learn.
Right.
And a lot of people are now using Blackboard and other kinds of technologies to help engage students, so it's more.
But the issue with that is it's usually locked down. Right, it's closed to the class, only the class. And now there may be good reasons, pedagogical reasons, to close things down. I can understand that. But I think this tendency to shut and lock is really problematic. The tendency should be, you need to justify why this needs to be locked. Otherwise, it's open. We're blurring the boundary between the classroom and the world. We're blurring the boundaries between institutions, between what goes on in a philosophy class and what goes on in a policy decision in Washington. Right? We want to be able to allow for that common discussion to happen with the links, as you mentioned at the end of the book. Right. So I worry, or one of the things that I'm really trying to advocate is this sort of open education movement where we put these things out there. It's our responsibility as educators, partly because I come from a university that's a land-grant university that should have its values in making education accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it goes across the board, this stuff should be out there. People should be able to hear it, engage it, transform it.
Yeah, it's frightening for professionals to do that because it means a loss of control.
Right.
And I've been in meetings with about this very issue in the public broadcasting world.
Right.
And PBS is the exemplar of, no, we have to control the content.
Yeah.
We can't. Well, they have all these channels with the new digital stuff.
Right,
They have more channels than they have content. They don't know what to do. So
they've got a great app for the iPhone, and I can get it anywhere. But it is their control.
It's their control. Yeah. They could create spaces for people, others to use it, others to create content. But the worry, at least, I don't know, in the past year under the new president, but the worry is that, well, if we do that, we can't control it, and people trust PBS. They trust us.
Right.
And what if we open it up and people who are untrustworthy come in?
Right.
Or the professor. What if I open it up and it's something untoward happens?
Right.
It's frightening.
Yeah.
It's kind of the fear of the democratic rabble out there.
Right. Well, I mean, you do mention at the end of the book in that chapter, I think, on the media about professionalism and how professionalism is being transformed. That's my one of my interests is how do we deal with that fear, that reaction that says, no, this is too much, I'm closing it down. We got to close it down and rally. I mean, isn't this related to the whole issue of repression, suppression, exclusion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it calls on the professional to change understanding the profession. Say, newspapers used to be in the business of just providing the content and putting it out there.
Right.
Now there's content being produced by, at CNN they have like the I forget what they call it, but so everybody can upload their content. And now it's the job of CNN, that hasn't been doing it very well, to actually edit the content, to say, to make judgments, professional judgments about what is newsworthy, what is important for us to discuss and spend 3 hours on, more than the boy in the, that wasn't the balloon.
Right.
To use judgment. So we don't need to go to a realtor to list a house anymore, but we need to go to a realtor to help us figure out what we, to help for their judgment.
Right.
And I think that in all these professions that's, so we can open up control as a professor, but realize we still have something that's worthwhile.
Sure.
That we have spent years.
And we have a responsibility to lay out certain kinds of parameters, expectations, to if something that does happen in this community that is inaccurate or wrong or what those. That's the time when you too. I mean, the faculty member is a participant in the community. Right, and that's I think that shift from being a participant in the community you've helped create in the classroom, and beyond, versus being in control in this kind of didactic, dogmatic, almost. I mean, you can be pretty undogmatic in your intellectual life, but pretty didactic in your teaching style. Can we live in that? Can we live in that world? And also, what do we need to learn as educators, as journalists, as members of society, to cultivate communities where people are included, where we can hear the voice of the other, where we are transformed by that? I think that's not an easy thing for people to deal with.
But it's happening all over. It's right. Not just the internet. I think the internet's a part of it. But there is a shift, a kind of paradigm shift in the way we think about power and authority. Mm-hmm. And I think the 20th century was really steeped in this notion that power is from on high. And if you were down below underneath that, you wanted to fight the power, which was up high.
Mm-hmm.
It was always one-way hierarchical conception of power and privilege and authority.
Right.
And now you can see it in all corners all over the world. There are, in a way, horizontal, relational kind of powers emerging.
Mm-hmm.
The way Hannah Arendt talked about kind of this web of power
that
can be created through our relationships, interactions with others.
Right.
And it happens in poor communities in Malaysia that where the government's dysfunctional, so the people themselves have to figure out how to get some kind of economy working.
Mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
you can see it happening in, you know, in the poor communities in San Antonio that are forming through community organizing, powerful organizations.
Right.
Powerful not in the sense of, you know, the power of the gun or coercion,
but
powerful in the sense of podere, to be able to act.
Exactly.
And that is threatening to those professionals who used to have all the power, but it's an opportunity for professionals like you who want to help cultivate that kind of power.
Right. Well, it brings me to the back to the course that I had taught about the distinction between force and power, and I draw on Arendt's use of power as related to Macht and Mugen, to be able, and then relating that back to also the Greek word for dunamis, ability to be able to, which is also linked, I think, very closely to the questions of how we habituate in the sense of hexis, in the Deweyan sense of habit, rather than in the Aristotelian sense of hexis, these excellences that will allow us to generate community or to create communities, cultivate communities that are not rooted in this kind of imposition violent founding metaphor that's often used, and not only a metaphor but actually enacted in horrible ways in reality. So one of the things I really appreciated about your book was the giving us a vocabulary for which to think that through in relation to the public sphere. And so thank you for giving me an opportunity to read it and for coming to the Digital Dialogue.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed it.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U on the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. This has been The Digital Dialogue.